to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Good morning, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and this is a pre-recorded interview for October 11th, 2016. Now, for all of you out there, you've probably read a million news articles about the Syrian conflict, and it is something that's very near and dear to all of our hearts. We're following it all the time. If you are not familiar with the Syrian people, they're some of the most beautiful, loving people I have had the blessing of meeting myself. In fact, I have several friends that are from Syria. And because of that, if you haven't already found this out, the Syrian conflict is entering its fifth year, okay? I mean, it is representing the largest displacement crisis in the world. And in fact, half of its population is requiring humanitarian aid. Half. 4.3 million lives as refugees in nearby countries such as Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and another 6.5 remain still within the boundaries and borders of Syria itself. Nearly half of the people that are in distress and affected by this conflict in Syria are children, 5.6 million. So this ongoing civil war really depends on humanitarian aid for food, clothing, shelter, etc. And so I'm not sure how many of you are aware of Doctors Without Borders. It's also known as Medicine Sans Frontiers, MSF for short. And they are committed to saving lives by providing medical aid where it is needed most. And this is typically in the armed conflict locations of around the planet, epidemics, natural disasters, and other crisis situations. Many contexts call for rapid response, employing specialized medical and logistic help. But we also run, they also run longer-term projects, such as tackling health crises for those particular locations. Now, supposedly the top five are Central Africa Republic, Nepal, Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Syria. So there's a high level of sacrifice involved for the workers of Doctors Without Borders. They go into some very, very challenging locations, not only because of war, not only because of disease, also cultural differences, conflicts, etc. So I really want to take my hat off to these people, and I just happened to run into none other than Helen Leatham. And Helen Leatham had stepped up to talk with me about becoming an ambassador with Galactic Connection for the Australia location that she lives in. And she has an amazing background. I mean, once I saw this, I said, woman, we've got to interview you. You've got an incredible background. She has so much to share with the world. I really feel like this is going to be an eye-opener for myself as well as everyone else. Now, Helen has been, her background is a Bachelor of Arts of Applied Science. She's a nurse. She's an RN. She has a graduate support program under her belt. I know the educational system's a bit different in Australia than it is in the United States, but this woman has incredible qualifications that I'm looking at as I speak with you. And a lot of training in transitions, tropical diseases in Africa, as well as healthcare emergency preparations, which is what she was involved in with Doctors Without Borders. She also has a great deal of background with the Aboriginal communities as an RN. I can't wait to hear about that as well. And so I took it upon myself, timing-wise, that this could not be the most perfect time to bring her forth to talk a little bit about what's really a typical scenario when you go into these either war-torn or very high-diseased, high-emergency situations. So we'll go ahead and dive in now. Thanks, Helen, for coming on. I am so excited about this interview because it's near and dear to my heart. I love medicine. So,
yeah, thank you. It's a honor. Thank you.
Yeah, it's an honor to meet you. And now, first and foremost, I mean, she gave me a slew of reports of the capacity in which she was working with. My eyes were just like, oh, my God. And she went to three different locations herself. She went to Zeri Desht, which was in Afghanistan from February 2003 on. She also went to the El Kher. That was in May through October 2003, and that was in North Sudan. She also went into Jumla, Nepal, and that was in December of 2003 through March of 2004. She speaks very highly of Doctors Without Borders, and I personally thought just some of the experiences and conditions that she worked within would be really eye-opening. So, Helen, I think what I want to start out with is just, how did this all begin for you? How did you stumble into starting to work for, I know it's called MSF or Doctors Without Borders?
There was when I was about 14, I actually saw the refugees in a camp at that time. And I think that was Ethiopia because that was quite some time ago. And I realized I had to do something. So I just got on with my normal life and went to uni and did nursing and went to England for a while and came back. And, after I'd done all that, I was about 30, I decided, well, I don't really want to stop. I don't have children at the moment, so I'll keep working. And I was working with a doctor who supported MSF. And as soon as I read that they were non-political and non-religious, I just thought, yeah, they're the ones that I want to do. So I applied for the job. And they said, no, definitely not. You don't have enough experience. You need to work in an Aboriginal community for at least 6 weeks and you need to do a 3-month tropical medicine course. I said, yeah, right, great. I'll do that. So I rang the Aboriginal community and they said, well, we don't like people coming for 6 weeks because it's too short a time. You don't get to connect. I said, fine. Can I do 6 months? And they said, yes. And then I paid for my ticket to go over to Liverpool for 3 months to finish the tropical medicine course, and then about 6 months after that, I got my first mission.
Yeah. Wow. And so when you are called to go into some of these locations, what is the main mission of Doctors Without Borders?
Yeah, well, I believe it's the French word is témoignage, which is to bear witness. So for instance, in Afghanistan, the war was raging and Pakistan closed its borders. So those people who are actually not refugees because they didn't make it across the border, they're still in the same country, so they're internally displaced peoples. They were going to be forced somewhere. So instead of just letting them be dumped somewhere, we're there ready to accept them and to see how their living conditions are and to make sure, you know, everything's set up in place. And then to be there to bear witness to what is actually happening, because the MSF don't report on anything that they don't, you know, personally experience themselves.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. What's the typical size of the staff, because I would imagine it might be difficult to have enough staff to go into these types of locations.
When it started, we had a couple of specialists come in, like a midwife came for 3 months and someone else came in for 3 months, and then I was there for 9 months. We were the main crew, was only four of us, so logistician, nurse, head nurse, and the in charge person. So that was it. But then you have a massive local staff. So in the end, I had 90 Afghan staff.
And so one of the things I noticed was in one of your reports, you were expecting up to 60,000 people to come through. And I think it only ended up being 30,000. But still, that's a lot of people to assist with disease and health issues.
Yeah, well, when they chose the spot, they chose Zeredash, which means yellow desert. And where it was, when the Russian were fighting in Afghanistan, they used that, they had a Russian base there, so the place was full of mines. And they chose this site as a flat site, but it actually was a landmine site. So they had to go about clearing the whole area, and it was all desert, all sand, so they had to start boring water. So to start off, it was empty desert land with landmines that had to be cleared and, you know, start with the water supply.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
So it started off with zero, but it ended up with 30,000 after about 3 months.
Yeah. My God. Now, who funds Doctors Without Borders?
Well, it's totally private. They don't let anybody fund from political or governments. It's self-fundraising. Yeah. So, but they don't. The reason that they don't take from any governments is that they won't be swayed by government policies or whatever. So they'll go wherever they want. So that's why they have private funding, which is really important.
You've experienced that personally. I know in some of your reports, it was just, I mean, it was like reading a book, you know. I felt like I was there.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, once you got to your first location in Afghanistan, I'm sure that there was a great deal of stress, and the fact that you were having to overcome cultural blockages and things like that. I mean, are you fluent in a lot of different dialects and languages?
Not fluent, I wouldn't say, but I did pick up a lot of the Pashtun language. And what I find is when you're talking about medical things, it's quite easy to get by. Do you know what I mean? Where you got a sore tummy, how does that mean? Yeah, you don't always need words, but we did always have a local interpreter with us as well. So yeah, but I learned a lot of Pashtun, and the main thing with Pashtun is that there's a specific greeting which is important to say with every person, and once you say that, you're opening the doors to more communication.
Right on. So how did you find the Afghanistan people as far as the receptivity to you all arriving there?
Well, MSF had been working with the Taliban for 10 or 12 years before the war started. So we had a head office which was right opposite the Taliban's head office. So just before the Americans bombed their head office, they had already moved into the MSF building across the road. So when I got there, we were in that building, and the guards showed us pictures of when they were guarding the Taliban, because they just let them in to live there while we were gone.
Oh my God. Oh wow. So what were the conditions? I mean, why, first of all, why were you called into that location? And secondly, what were the conditions of the people? How do they live?
Well, I came in through Turkmenistan and drove through from Ashgabat, the capital of Turkmenistan, which is up to the north northwest. And so when you're crossing the first border, it's like going into another world, because you're going from, you know, high communism, high building structures, concrete, to, you know, goats everywhere, dirt roads, little shacks. And it's mind-blowing, the activity on the roads. You know, you've got sheep, people, ladies in burqas, cars going everywhere. It's just like, oh. But one of the things is, MSF never drives in a country. We always have a local driver, you know, in case of accidents and suing and that sort of issue.
Well, and I noticed you have a requirement of guards and security force. So I would imagine, is it pretty typical that wherever the Doctors Without Borders staff go, they have to have security to support them?
Yeah, they have to have a whole team of locals on the ground, and the locals are always, yeah, the security is always locals, because if you don't have people speaking the language, you don't know the intel of what's going on. So in a dangerous situation, there's a security meeting every morning and you get all the locals in, and what's anything going on, anything to be worried about. And, I mean, they're the people that keep you alive, because they're telling you what's happening. So
unbelievable. And so what was the main threat as far as responding to the call to get to Afghanistan? What was the health threat?
Well, the health threat was that they were closing the border, and that they wanted, that there was going to be a stack of people that needed to go somewhere, and they were going to need to set up a camp. So it was to be there for that, and to be ready to have them somewhere and accept them to be able to give medical care.
So are you also involved in setting up the camps themselves? Are you coordinating and networking with other locals doing that, or are you just strictly working on the health emergency preparation response team kind of stuff?
Yeah, there's a lot of coordination between other agencies. So you've got someone who's providing the food, someone the water, someone the tent, someone to help digging, and we're just doing the medical supplies. So, yeah, you have to work together totally from scratch to know what each other is doing.
Did you have to get a lot of inoculations and, you know, to be able to do this kind of work, to go into these areas?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. And I would imagine the training to get prepared for this, was there also training for crisis situations? Because I noticed in one of your explanations, one of the doctors had to be evacuated because it was just so emotionally stressful. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I would imagine that whatever you have on resume as far as your abilities isn't necessarily what you can handle stress-wise.
And that's why they say, you know, as an Australian, you need to work in an Aboriginal community, because you have to be remote and realise what are you going to do and what have you got to do it with. And that's what you have to deal with. Yeah, it depends what you have. And so, being remote, and also you do a primary preparation course where you do have kidnap training, and you do a sort of group activity where you're supposed to do a certain amount of things to get to a certain point. Only the things that you need to get to finish the task are not there. So how are you going to work as a team to finish your task, which is actually impossible to finish?
My God. So when you arrived in Afghanistan and you had this response of the refugee camp situation, what did you find? Tell us a little bit about what was a typical day for you, and how did you feel when you got there?
Oh, it was a couple of months when I was there before it actually started. I was working in another site before that Zeridasht actually opened. So we were living in the main part of Kandahar, and yeah, basically we're just doing basic health in that centre and getting ready for Zeridasht to open. It was so it's very hot. It was the middle of summer, so that's about, you know, 55 degrees. You'd have to drink, you know, 4 to 5 litres a day of water, and you, basically the lunches, you get fresh bread every day from the people that, you know, they put it on the side of the wall there, the concrete wall. The cook would go and get some fresh yogurt in a bucket, come to, and then you'd get cucumber, watermelon and tomato, and you put heaps of powdered salt, natural salt, on it to keep the salt up. That was just to keep yourself going.
Wow.
Yeah, because it was just that hot. So those people, when they were coming in cattle trucks, basically, Pakistani cattle. You don't say cattle. You know, their trucks are a bit different. They're all made up with decorations and stuff, and they don't only have – they're in the back of that truck with only a sheet over their head sort of thing, a canvas. So they've been driving from the border of Pakistan up to there for 5 to 6 hours by the time they arrive. So they're coming off all dusty, dirty, dehydrated. They're already displaced people, so they've already been living in a camp somewhere else. So there was, you know, a lot of malnourishment to start off with, you know, heat, things like that. Yeah.
So it says here that one of the number one issues is dehydration.
Yeah.
And is that because there is a lack of access to water, or is it because the water itself is already polluted?
No, the water is very good there. It's beautiful. It's mostly just because of the heat, because you just it's just so hot that even just drinking water alone is not enough. So it would only take a slight amount of illness to get you further dehydrated in those conditions. Yeah.
Wow. And now, are most of these people not very well off? I mean, what are their living conditions?
There was three different types of people in the camp. There was, because the Taliban were a Pashtun race, then the Pashtuns were, they were the displaced because they were running because there's a change of power, so suddenly they were fleeing. And you also have the Kuchis, which are the indigenous race of Afghanistan and that region, I would say, not only Afghanistan, but they're the tribal nomadic people that just travel the country, surviving with their cattle and families, just on the move all the time. So they were stopped from being able to do that because of the unsafe surroundings and the war going on. So they're two completely separate. So these the Pashtuns are very educated, city-type folk, you know, well-dressed and always in the burqas, but the Kuchis are very colourful and they don't cover their face fully, but they wear a lot of art and they paint their baby's eyes black and stuff.
Wow.
Like that. Yeah.
And why do they do that? Is it just heritage or...?
It's a heritage thing, I think, but they use charcoal, which is a cleanser as well. So I think it probably helps to keep the infections out of the baby's eyes as well as spiritual protection.
Fascinating. You must have just loved this.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I mean, really. And so it says here that, you know, your responsibility was to make sure that the patients were safe, that people maintained their privacy, that you educated the staff, followed all the procedures of the Doctors Without Borders guidelines, and monitored all the consultations and treatment. So tell me a little bit about what were some of the challenges in that responsibility.
Well, as we first opened, it was extremely challenging because there was a lot of, you know, sick people in the beginning. So the one of the biggest challenges was actually sorting out how the people are going to flow through the unit. Do you know what I mean? Cause we had to set up the basic health unit, which is basically just some mesh fencing with some tents. So we decided to design it, you know, with a entrance, and then because we've got only local staff, we worked out a colour card system. So the gut, you know, you ask the people, are they coming because of midwifery or children, malnutrition, or to see a doctor or for a wound, and whatever they would be coming for, they'd get a different coloured card and they'd walk through to that tent and then follow that through out the other side to the pharmacy and then out the gate that way.
Crazy. And so when you first got there, did you speak their language at all?
No, I just, because I made an effort to listen, it was like everybody wanted to teach me more and more words. So as soon as I was preaching, everybody was really happy. And I found the people just amazing. And I know that they are strict against women, but they seem to take me in as like a family member, as a sister.
Yeah, you know? Tell everybody that story. Tell everybody, that's a cool story.
They're not allowed to see any women outside their own family in the flesh, because all women in Afghanistan are pretty much covered up, so they never see their face. But Westerners are not allowed to cover their face. They have to be seen to be Western women in the town. And yeah, so I found, because I've made a big effort with the locals, that they all invited me to their homes at different times for dinner to meet the rest of their family, and I was just treated like a sister or a daughter. It was just such an amazing connection I had with them.
What did you feel that the Afghanistan people perceive outside their own country?
Now, that's pretty bad, because as the Americans went into there, they sort of, being liberated, so to speak, they sort of, the worst of the worst comes through first. So there's an increase in porn, or, you know, just the mainstream media, and what you're getting is not a real view. So they think of us as infidels. And from what they see and the glimpses they get, you have to only agree that from what they're seeing, yes, that is what we look like. Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame. And so tell us a little bit about the local staff. You know, what were some of the challenges working with all of them?
Well, it was really good. I found that the female, we only had about 10 females and about 80 males, but the females were more challenging, because, as you can imagine, they've grown up and been educated in a very difficult country. And, they're very strong women. They gave me a lot of grief. But I also had a really good situation. One of my pharmacists was actually a refugee, and he thought that I didn't trust him, but I found him very capable, very educated, very professional. And I said, no, don't worry about it. I don't mind that you're from the camp. He said, well, in 3 months after my third pay, would you come to my place and have lunch? Mm-hmm. I said, yes, I'd love to. And he goes, and you can bring 12 people. I said, right, okay. So 3 months later, when he got his third pay, we went for lunch, and I had the choice of picking. So I bought two guards, a local woman, uneducated. There was a few other women there, and, yeah, a couple of nurses, a couple of doctors, and we all sat down. And he sat with us and ate, and his brother, who used to be a principal in a school, served us the lunch, and the ladies cooked it for us. Yeah. And that was impressive, because women and men were not allowed to sit together. And guards would never sit also with everybody else. So one of the guards came in, and one of the guards was so excited and so honoured. He goes, no, I'm going to sit out the front of the tent, and I'm going to guard this tent with my lunch out here.
Even more so, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, it's amazing, yeah.
Now, what type of food do they eat?
In the summer it's really just local bread each day and local fruit. I found that the fruit and vegetables in Afghanistan really opened my eyes to be the best in the world. So seasonal, so fresh, so delicious. It was just amazing, because they do use a lot of deep irrigation to flood their crops. So it's... Wow. The most beautiful watermelon and pomegranate in the world that I know of. And then there's a lot of, so in the refugee camp we'd have a cook, and we'd just have basically rice with a chickpea type tomato based stuff, mm-hmm. and on the side yogurt with cucumber, and that would be pretty much the same every day, but it was always beautiful.
Yeah. I love that stuff. That's good stuff. Well, now you also mentioned here that you had to negotiate with the local head of the government, the chief of the police and the head of the army. Right?
Yeah, that was in Nepal, though.
Oh, that was in Nepal. Okay.
Yeah.
So once you got the whole camp established, what was your next step, and what did you end up, you know, receiving? Like, did they just come in droves, or how did that end up?
In the beginning, it was the busiest time, because that's when, you know, they were filling up and they're sick and unwell. So we were having, you know, like 1,000 visits a week in the busiest time. And then, you know, when they came, we had quite a lot of malnutrition, quite a lot of, sick women and the babies. So... Yeah, can't really think.
That's tough. I mean, and, you know, I noticed that the staffing was really challenging for you because they either didn't have maybe as high of a work ethic, the locals. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or if they did, they weren't as organized in making sure that they followed the procedures. So how did you overcome that with the locals? Because I would imagine there would be some cultural antagonism.
Yeah, there was. I had a lot of issues with the doctors because we didn't always have a doctor in our mission to, you know, supervise them. So I ended up doing that some of the time, which as a nurse, you don't oversee doctors in any country. So that makes it difficult, but in Afghanistan, really. So, I did fire one doctor because he wouldn't communicate or look at me. So, yeah, but then I had a lot of trouble getting the doctors. I couldn't figure out why the bus could not get to the camp on time. And I realised it was because the doctors were always running late and they were not allowed to leave before the doctors. So by the time I figured this out, I had to go out there first thing in the morning and I had to chase them around the car, get them all in and push them off before the doctor arrived. And the doctor ended up catching a taxi there and was never late again.
Good for you. Good for you. Now, what were the requirements to hire the local staff?
Well, there weren't many. I just basically did the interviews with one local person, and I just played it by ear and went with who I could. In the end, I was really struggling to get enough doctors, and I had a bit of trouble, getting them in the van because. Well, first of all, one, I said to the staff, and they take things quite literally, I said, now we've got a doctor who's coming on board, but you have to leave on time. So they left on time and forgot the doctor. Well, the next day we had another new doctor starting, and when I got to the camp, you know, the doctor's sitting there like this and he can't even lift his head up and he's really distressed. And I'm like, are you okay? And he's like, no, I did not want to work in a refugee camp. And we basically had to carry him out and send him back home. And then I realised what had happened. The staff, because I told them, please make sure the doctor gets on the bus. They had basically pushed him in the bus. I said, so really we've kidnapped him, is that right? Yes. Okay. Let's get him home and get him safe. So he was a local man and he couldn't deal with being in the camp situation, in the hot with the people. It was just too much for him as a local. So
yeah, because of what he knew and what he had seen, right? It's too close to his heart.
Yeah.
Now, I also noticed that you were responsible for registering all the children and their births and that sort of thing. Did you have any kind of, I don't know, hesitation to that? Because I know inoculations were like a part of this as well. How did you feel about that, I guess is what I'm saying? You know, because with those of us that have eyes to see now, we're a little bit apprehensive about going down that road because it's very governmentally monitoring.
Yeah. Well, I had my doubts then and I have my doubts now, and I didn't have a lot to do with the vaccination program because that was sort of separate to the basic health unit. So I didn't really have a lot to do with it, but it's questionable, I think, yeah.
And now who is the main drug company that is working with Doctors Without Borders? You know, it's providing the pharmaceuticals and the injections.
I couldn't even tell you that, but I know that the main pharmacy for MSF is in Europe, so they get it all from over there, so I couldn't say. I don't know. I'd imagine.
I'm just curious. Yeah. It'd be really interesting to follow that lead, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
To see what's involved. And now you also talked about the number of people that were coming in with illnesses and chronic disabilities. Can you give us an idea of, you know, what was a typical day for those that came forth that needed health care?
We had a lot of malnourished children at the beginning, so for them they would come through each day and we would give them extra nutrition bars. So, for example, and then we'd get their address and we'd basically follow them up because they'd need extra support to get past the emergency phase. So what we did is set up a program for the ladies or mothers or fathers to come in and to be weighed and looked after and take care of that baby to support their nutrition. So we had to continue to follow up as well. But, the ladies who were coming in, with just lots of diarrhea, lots of chest infections, stuff like that, and basically just seeing the doctor for that. And a few wounds, a lot of wounds in the summer when it was hot because of the flies and the conditions.
Yeah. Now, I mean, is that from the fact that they just don't have enough to eat? Or is it actually because they're not drinking enough water? Is it because it's too hot? Is it because it's a war area and they've run out of that location? I mean, what was the main reason for such a significant amount of the infections that you ran into?
I would say at that time in the summer, it was the heat and the dust and, a little bit of lack of malnutrition, but that soon changed once they were established there. But just so hot and dusty and dirty. So, there's clean water to drink, but there's not really clean water for washing and that stuff.
So bathing and hygiene was an issue. Is that something you had to teach them as well?
Well, they'd always, want soap for us to give them soap, but that's not something that we really had a lot of. So, so they'd be asking for that type of stuff,
Interesting. How did the locals respond to you arriving there? I mean, was there hostility immediately because you were, you're a Western organization?
No, because we had been there for such a long time and built up a trust. And, so we had staff that had been working us for a long time. So I didn't find that at all, no.
Wow. And is there a problem with the people just procreating and having tons and tons of children?
Yes.
Yeah, same thing.
I remember one lady who was, I think it was her 12th average is, about 8, but then a lot of the babies actually die, before they're 1. So, if they had 8, she'd probably have 5 that are probably alive.
Oh, and is AIDS really prevalent in Afghanistan?
I didn't see any AIDS and we didn't test for AIDS at the time. And another thing that I didn't get out of 30,000 is probably I only saw one person with cancer. Possibly, which was interesting. So it goes to show that they're pretty healthy.
That is very interesting.
They don't have any toxins. So what I was always thinking in that place, 30,000 people in this rough place and, you got diarrhea and people dying from other things, but I haven't seen any cancer. And one of the reasons might be that they just die before they get there. But, I didn't see any.
Do they live fairly short lives because of the heat and the dehydration factor?
Yeah.
Oh, man. And so is it fairly normal that when a mom gives birth, there's a really high propensity to lose the child?
Yeah, it's quite dangerous for midwifery.
Sad. Over
pretty high mortality right there.
So sad. And it says here, if you determine the weight of the baby between 70-80% of where it was supposed to be, then you gave them biscuits.
Yeah, well, they're the nutritional biscuits.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I thought that was...
Not just cheap biscuits. They're the high protein biscuits specifically designed for those children to boost them up without overloading their system.
That's crazy. So now, how about as far as... the location, I would imagine you would choose a location that's not right in the heat of the war area, but I would imagine that it still would be considered a very dangerous location because they think that you're supporting the locals and helping them live. So how did you overcome that factor? I know you had guards, but it doesn't seem like a couple of guards around a tent's going to do much.
No. When you got B-52 bombers flying over the refugee camp. Well, our office was actually in Kandahar, and every morning to go to the camp, it was a 45-minute drive. And I was going to tell you this because you went past the same mountain every day in the same fields and the same irrigation and whatever, but it was like the molecules of the land were bigger because it was never boring. The mountain used to change and evolve, and it's just rocks, but you'd be like, oh, I don't know what it is about this place, but it's just beautiful. Oh. So, yeah, it was 20 minutes up the main road and then 20 minutes up a dirt road to the camp, which was then it would show where it was the landmines had been cleared and where they hadn't. So you just have to go through that as well. So that was every day driving back and forth. So it was, it didn't seem to be dangerous, but there were landmines on the side of the road that somebody ran over at some stage. Yeah, but we didn't.
So basically it's not like you could just, go take a stroll.
No, you can't. But at the camp, I felt pretty safe because, I'd be there every day with just the locals pretty much. And
it's crazy.
Yeah, we did have people turn up with guns tapping on the door and the guards sent them away. And I said, oh, no, please don't do that. We don't want to make them angry. Just come and get me. So on the way home, I just stopped over and I said, hey, sorry about that. I didn't know that you'd came. I'll be there any day if you want to come and visit.
That's crazy. And what about the delivery of the babies? So you used a lot of midwives. Were they locals typically?
Yeah, all locals, yeah.
Because that way they wouldn't resist the assistance, right?
Oh, they were happy to have the assistance if they were there. Yeah, they were happy to see the midwives. They had no issue, but they were all locals, yeah. I did have to deliver one baby because they said, oh, you have to deliver a baby. I said, what do you mean, where's the midwife? She's out at the camp. I said, well, can you call her on the radio? No, the radio's broken in that ambulance. I was like, oh, no. Well, isn't there any other women here? No, you're the only one. You have to do it. I was like, oh, no. So I cut the cord and did all that, and then the Afghan midwife, who's pretty tough, Kumar, came back and she goes, oh, my God, you've cut the cord too short. I went, oh, my God. What does that mean? Is the baby going to die? Oh, but anyway, the baby was fine.
Yeah. But I would imagine you just have to go with the flow and whatever takes place, because your report is showing that there were typically always limited medications,
yeah,
limited staff, or I should say trained staff.
Yeah, yeah.
And this just cracked me up. You said... You said, we have recently started a bit of a pathetic family planning program. By pathetic, I mean simply that we had only 10 Depo-Provera in stock, and more Depo-Provera and birth control pills are on order. So I bet, how did the women react to the fact that if they could take this, they didn't have to get pregnant all the time?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I didn't have a lot to do with that because I wasn't the midwife. So we had the local midwives and a trained international midwife overseeing them. So I just kept the program running because I'm certainly not a midwife. So I didn't have a lot to do with that. I was mainly focused on the kids with malnutrition and making sure the nurses were doing the right thing. And because we didn't have doctors, also trying to check them for not giving out too many medications, too many antibiotics.
And so would the medications arrive on like a regular basis and then be stopped because you were in some dangerous location? Or,
well, no, that they could be stopped for any reason, but basically what we had to do was sit down one day and figure out what we were going to need for possibly 60,000 people over the next 6 months and do an order.
Got it.
And that was a bad. I was like, oh, okay, let me just think about that for a
moment. That's crazy, huh? Really crazy. So now, did you feel that the registration of the children, was there some resistance from the locals about that? Where they didn't really want to be known by some sort of what they would perceive to be an institution?
No, I didn't find that. No, they were pretty good. They were happy to be there because, you know, they were sick and they wanted the medicines. What we found is that they didn't like our medicines because they weren't coloured and they're used to having coloured medicines from Pakistan. So all the antibiotics are coloured capsules and we had plain white tablets. So there was quite a significant number of meetings for us to basically try and convince them that our tablets were real. They were valid, they were effective, and you can trust us. They are real tablets, real medicines, although they don't have colours.
Yeah. Whoa. I would imagine you had to deal with a lot of paranoia as far as, you know, they looking at you and saying, why are you helping us?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, we're giving completely different things than they're used to. So, yeah, I'm sure that was, yeah.
I was going to say. And so tell us a little bit about one of your most memorable experiences there in Afghanistan.
There's so many. What I found, you know, being in such an intense war zone is that, you know, one day just feels like so much can happen in one day that it feels like sort of the time is different, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
One day feels like a week, so much happened. So, yeah, it was just constant happening.
But I mean, anything really memorable that you just felt was so life-changing for you, you know, even if it was an interaction with a patient or a doctor?
Well, we had one interaction. We had a very malnourished baby and we went to find out, you know, why weren't they attending? Was there anything we could do? And we found out that it was because the mother had died and there was only the father left who was quite elderly. So we said, oh, that's fine. If we support you and help you, you know, come to the clinic, would you come? You know, so, and he said, oh, yes, I would. So he came every day and we take the baby off him and weigh them and give them the food and, you know, encourage him. And he just loved it.
Beautiful.
And the baby made a full recovery. It was really nice.
Did you find the men to be very participatory with the children?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's neat. And now I also noticed that one of your issues was the instruments for, you know, maybe surgery or wound care were not getting sterilized.
Yeah. Yeah, we had to get, you're using basic things. So you're basically in a dust bowl. So you're using basic kidney dishes and gentian violet, which is the purple, bright purple stuff to clean things with, to keep the equipment clean, but it was always an issue. But that was really just basic health. So we actually weren't allowed to do too much intervention. So we'd have an ambulance system of just, you know, minivans that would take them to the local hospital if it was serious, because basically we couldn't do, you know, complicated care there at all.
Oh,
we'd,
okay.
We'd be
so
death.
Like major surgeries where maybe a leg's blown off or something, stepping on a landmine, you guys wouldn't handle that kind of stuff?
No, we couldn't. No.
Okay.
No. So, and that's one of the stipulations for being in the country. You're not allowed to do too much intervention. That was what we were allowed to do. So we're not allowed to just go into surgery, and it can be very tough and you can be kicked out of a country for doing more than you are allowed to do in that country when they have a system that's set up. So we just had to transport those critically injured patients to the hospital and let the locals deal with it there. We did have some workers within the hospital helping with that system as well, but I wasn't really involved with that. So,
was the ambulance system part of the whole Doctors Without Borders program? Or
we organized that too, because it was 45 minutes away. We also had to, you know, get our staff to the camp. So we had to pick up all the women and drop them home from their doors before dark, and pick up the men and get them to the camp. So we just used those minibuses then as extra transport. And what I was going to say earlier, for the security, we'd have, you know, full Afghan dress with a headscarf plus an MSF vest, which then you'd have to have a walkie-talkie radio on, which had to be connected to the driver in the car and be in sight of the driver. And then you'd have $100 US at the time and a passport, because that would be your kidnap money to try and get out of that. And yeah, there was constant communication. So even in the cars, as you're leaving the main base, the driver's telling you that they're leaving, and you're keeping in radio contact the whole time too.
So you've brought up the kidnapping a couple times. Was that, not only does it sound like you just kind of had to expect it or get prepared for it, but how often did that happen?
Well, it didn't happen that often, but while I was overseas, one of the guys who was in Georgia, in Russia, the over that region, he got kidnapped for, it was more than 17 months, I believe, and so he was in, he was there for a long time. But as we the first day we drove into the country, we're traveling through from the north to the south of Afghanistan, and we stopped in a highly Taliban area to have lunch under a bridge in a dry riverbed. And, along came the Taliban with their guns, and we, hi, would you like some lunch with us? Yeah, and they had lunch with us, and, you know, we were respectful and open, and they just moved on.
Wow. Helen, I cannot believe your life. I mean, how exciting, and at the same time, how dangerous.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So I would say that would be a memorable moment, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that was pretty memorable. And, I accidentally hired a Taliban doctor one day. That was pretty memorable, because that was a bit of a mistake.
Why? What happened?
Oh, it was a Sunday. Oh, it could have been Friday, because I think that was our day off. My boss said, you've got to interview a doctor. I said, there's no scheduled appointments for interviews for doctors today. He said, he's here. He needs an interview straight away. You're going to have to do it. I said, but I don't have a doctor on staff to interview with me, because I wouldn't interview a doctor without another doctor present. I'd be the nurse present.
Right.
So I was very reluctant and wondering why this was happening. And I was with my head nurse instead to do the interview. And I was very intimidated by this man, and wasn't performing the interview because I'm not a doctor. I wasn't sure what to do. But anyway, halfway through the interview, my staff member called me out and said, "Do you know who that is?" I said, "No, he said, that's one of the head torturers of the Taliban. He used to have the nurses tied up against a tree with their arms out and being whipped in the sun." I was like, "Oh, well, that's not good, because we're not supposed to have anything to do with the Taliban, because we'll attract the American military to, you know, bomb us or whatever, or come and search us. So, oh, what are we going to do now?" So I went back in, and I was still so intimidated that I actually gave him the job at the time, which I never did. But anyway, so I told my boss, we've just hired someone, a doctor from the Taliban. We're not sure if he's a real doctor or not. And he goes, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" I said, "I don't know. It's my day off. I'm not sure. You deal with it." But anyway, I think he got wind of it. We just didn't mention it again, and he didn't come back. So that was lucky.
Why do you think he did that?
I think that was as the increase humanitarian stuff was coming up, the Taliban were just starting to infiltrate back through the system. Mm-hmm. So they were coming through the system with the agencies and just infiltrating back into society again after leaving for some time.
Wow. That's just mind-blowing.
And, the other thing is I did get into the American military base because I had a sick child who swallowed a whistle. And
my God.
Yeah, so we couldn't facilitate having that. So my boss said, "You'll have to fix it." I said, "Oh, I'm not sure what to do." He goes, "Doesn't matter, just fix it." So I rang the ICRC, and we took him to the military base, because MSF is not allowed to have any access with military. So I used the International Committee for the Red Cross instead, which got us in to the main US base, into the ICU, where they had a quick look for me, and they were wonderful, the American military staff that were in there, and telling us that they were bored and they didn't have anything to do, and maybe you could bring some Afghans. And I was like, yeah, of course, I could bring people for referral or whatever. But 1 week later, there was an official notice from the head of the US military saying no Afghans would ever be allowed on the base again.
Because of political inferences, right?
Yeah, well, they thought that I was communicating properly with him, and they didn't like it.
Isn't that a shame, you know? Mm. The life of an individual being determined by what we think is has something to do with territories or you know, freedom. Mm. And we all find out later it has so much more to do with just being the pawn in a chess game for, you know, mining and minerals and money and pipelines, and it's just disgusting. So what about money? I know you probably had to have some money to be able to have that, for example, if you got kidnapped to negotiate. But was that an issue too? Because I would imagine that there's probably a lot of poverty in these locations, and wondering if that was, you know, something you had an ongoing issue with.
No, MSF is pretty fair with money. So what they do is they their rate of pay for the locals is usually at a local wage, whereas the UN pays much higher than local. We keep it at local, so then we're not changing the dynamics of the structure. And as for the volunteers, we get a minimum amount. I think it was about $600 a month or something. But then the food automatically comes off that, and our daily allowance, you know, basically $2 a day is, you know, all you needed for food and everything else to spend money on. I mean, there's not much to buy.
I was going to say, it's not like you're going to go down to the local mall or anything.
No, so basically we didn't have to deal with money at all.
Okay, well, that's good. What did you do on your time off? I mean, if you couldn't really cruise around outside the camp zone, what did you spend your time doing?
Well, we'd only have one day off a week.
Wow.
And towards the end, there were, you know, 16-hour days as we were evacuating, as the conditions were worsening. But I used to have tea and sweet lollies with the guards.
With the guards,
because the guard, you know, were at the front. So that was always fun to do. And, we'd just sit around and cook and, yeah, not very much at all, really. I mean, you can't go anywhere. Before the security worsened, we did go out for ice cream and go up to the main town. But, yeah, after 3 months or so, it was too dangerous to do that.
What had happened in that 3 months?
That had been basically the deterioration. So I can't remember if American had declared the war over at that point, but it was sort of, there was a honeymoon period after the Americans went in where it was all seemed okay. And then that honeymoon period really deteriorated quite rapidly and intensely. So, and I think it must have been, there was an attempted assassination on President Karzai.
Wow.
And yeah, all the others, the international staff were all over having a UN party, but I made a commitment not to drink any alcohol. So I stayed home. Yeah. And the first I heard about it was, a phone call, and I picked it up, and it was the French media saying, "Are you aware that President Karzai has been attempted assassination attempt?" I said, "No, I wasn't aware of that." They said, "Can you go outside on the street and check the situation?" I said, "No, I can't." Anyway, I got them off the line and quickly emailed. I was the first one to get in contact with all the international staff at the UN and saying, told them what happened. Next thing, you've got a F-16 fighter plane. Okay. You know, less than 50 metres above the house setting off its jets, and then four helicopters, because the military came in to evacuate Karzai, so they got four helicopters going up a mile away, doing a circle like this and all going off in the four directions.
Wow.
Too, so you don't know which plane it is, which helicopter. So it was quite intense.
This is like MASH all over again, isn't it? Did you ever watch that show, MASH?
Yeah, I did.
I used to watch it all the time.
Yeah.
Now, just a quick question. This is kind of a little bit off the subject. Getting back to the doctors, I mean, I would imagine that the doctors that would be willing to do this sort of work, they really have to have a place in their heart where they want to serve humanity. So Did you find them to be really skilled, the ones that were recruited by Doctors Without Borders? Because I noticed that some of them are like student doctors. So, yeah. Which would really give them a crash course in learning very quickly, very fast.
Yeah, well, because all the doctors we had were mostly local. I mean, they were up to the task, but you mean, for example, in Afghanistan, we couldn't get a doctor, international doctor, to come there. We had one come, but she didn't cope with the refugee situation and the whole situation, and she couldn't stay. And then basically we didn't get another doctor for that whole mission, until the very end.
Wow. So what would you do if you didn't have a doctor? The nurses just jump in and take over?
Oh, we'd have local doctors, no international.
Okay, the local doctors.
What I mean by that. So we had a head local doctor who was he was excellently skilled, and he used to help run the hospital and everything else. And then I had about four doctors that would work with me in the camp. And because it was basic, you're looking at GP type style, so they're not having to do massive surgeries or whatever. And I didn't really see any landmine stuff because the fighting was not actually going on at that point.
So I guess my big question is, for the local doctors to be so well trained is kind of surprising to me.
Well, a lot of them were trained in Pakistan. Kandahar is quite close to Pakistan, so Quetta would be the main Pakistani city. And because the Taliban were there, I found that a lot of our staff had been living in Pakistan and educated there and before they'd come back.
Wow. Was there kind of a competitiveness amongst the locals who really were desperate to get, say, their children that were being that were dehydrated, malnourished, really sick? If you had like 1,000 people, is that what you said? 1,000 people would come through a day?
At least 1,000 in the weeks, in a whole week when it was busy.
I mean, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, did you find that there was, kind of fighting or competition amongst them to get help, since there was like a certain number of staff?
I mean, when it was really busy, I did end up having to, go through the waiting room and find the most critical people to come in, come through and kick the rest out. So there was fighting over that. But as for fighting over the trained staff, I didn't really find that. Because there was plenty of people that were trained enough to hire, and we also took people that were completely illiterate and unskilled. We took a lady like that and trained her up because she's doing some certain skills, which is pretty easy to train. So, I mean, she just thrived. But there wasn't that many skilled people, so there wasn't fighting over it by any means. No,
that's good. And you mentioned that there was the monitoring of the cemeteries.
Yeah.
Now, how did the locals look at death, for example, regarding their own religion, typical religion in that location?
Yeah, well, that was the issue, because someone would die and basically they'd be buried before the morning. So we wouldn't be able to find out what they died of, whether there was some sort of, epidemic going on in the camp, because we saw that the deaths were increasing, and this was, getting to capacity, and it was getting colder, so colder at night, so the deaths were really rapidly increasing, which is why we put the guard at the cemetery, because they were getting buried in the night. We couldn't find where they were, so we couldn't follow up and find what was wrong with them. So, yeah, we put the guard at the cemetery to count and talk with the people that were burying people overnight. So, yeah. Well, so I went through that paperwork. There was about 83 by the end, yeah.
That's just crazy. And so they were dying just because of hypothermia and things like that?
Pretty much. There was usually some diarrhea. We didn't find any epidemic, as it were. It was just, just diarrhea and dehydration, so that the hypothermia gets them in the night.
And then what about hygiene? How did you deal with that? Because that's that can be kind of a sensitive subject where they feel maybe shame. I would imagine that could be emotionally triggering. I don't know. Just
Yeah, no, I didn't find that. If they were, you know, unclean, they were happy to, you know, get close and get angry about it to try and get some soap off us.
Really?
So women, you know, we were talking with women, so they wouldn't have said that to a man, but the women were, you know, quite aggressive at, you know, I need soap and, you know, here, look at this. And
So you're sitting here telling me that soap was like a major rare thing.
Yeah.
That's a trip. Tell me, what type of buildings did they live in? Do they live in?
Oh, so in the old city, it's ancient city. I mean, it's thousands of years old. So it's really just dirt and mud walls that go up about 9 foot. And so every house in between is sort of dug out in sort of like caves, but they're obviously above ground. But because they're made of mud and clay, that's what they look like. And that's to keep the heat out. So they're, you know, all next to each other. But in a camp, it was just tents. So towards the end, no one had really made permanent structures, although they were allowed to stay there. So the permanent structures were latrines first off, and most people were just living in tents.
Yeah. That is so crazy. So before we move on to your next adventure, is there anything else that you can share with us that was pretty amazing that you experienced in Afghanistan?
I'm not sure of one thing. It was just amazing. I was very upset to be leaving there, and I just thought the people and the place, it was so intense, but such an amazing experience as well. I think towards the end, I remember we were one of our other organisations had a bomb thrown at them when one of our staff members over at night, it was a 200-pound TNT bomb thrown over the fence. So we were taping up our windows on the second floor to make them a bit more shatterproof in case a bomb was thrown over the fence. And, you know, the longer we were there, the more the deterioration happened. And in the end, they put notices up on the poll saying that there was a direct threat that we would be attacking Western women from now on. And that was the reason why we had to leave. But the shooting, I mean, we lived not far from the main prison. There was shooting and murders up there that we had to go past every day, and just bombs going off. And I even had a rocket launcher being put off basically 2 metres on the other side of a brick wall while we were having dinner.
Wow. And this was almost like normalcy for the locals, right? It had become a normal way of life to live in this war type of environment.
Yeah. So there was a real sense of fear because a lot of people had been traumatized from the regime, but not everybody. I mean, they're different ethnic groups, and when a different ethnic group goes into power, the others suffer. So, you know, everybody had really suffered a little bit under the Taliban as well, yeah.
What did you feel about, you know, because we all know that Russia was in Afghanistan in a big way at one time. What was their impression or opinion of the Russians?
Yeah, they're such strong people that just unite so amazingly, and it's quite obvious when you get there. You know, the Russians didn't win and the Americans really didn't win. You just can't take over a country like that that's so tribal and such ancient culture. Yeah, they're just more powerful because, you know, they'll change hats and, you know, one day they'll be with that group who's the winning group, and, you know, they'll swap hats and go over to that side because they're the people in power. So they'll just do whatever they need to keep going and keep working and keep surviving.
Great.
But what they found is that the security really deteriorated, so they really have a deep connection with family and religious holidays that they really need to travel the country to get back with family. So after the deterioration, when they couldn't do that, that's when the tension started to rise because it was supposed to be safer when the Americans were there, not deteriorate into worse. Yeah.
Interesting. And so once you were you evacuated out of there because of the threat against Western women?
Yeah, we were forced to leave, which I was extremely angry about. And by then, all the roads were completely unsafe to drive on to get back anywhere. So, and we ended up having to hire a small plane to get out of there from the military base there.
Wow!
Because we couldn't get out. So yeah.
That's so crazy. So, were you immediately placed into another location in North Sudan, or?
I think it was about it was about a week. That we just finished up the project and did the handover and then went on a plane to Herat. But then I had 3 months off and before I went to Sudan.
Because I was going to say, is there kind of like a, I'm not going to call it a debriefing, but it feels to me like you would need some emotional support after going through something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you get a quick debriefing basically in your head office, which for me was in Amsterdam. I'd go back there, yeah.
And how were you doing by the time you left? You're so calm. I mean, it's so mind blowing to talk to you because you're like, oh yeah, you know this, that, and the other. You know, how did you fare once you left? Because this was your first.
Yeah, well, I was so invested with the people and that we were staying there and that I didn't really find the threat the valid. So I was extremely angry when I left because I felt that I'd been pulled out. When I was not happy about it, so I was just extremely angry. And then, you know, as soon as the anger took hold, I just was crying. And yeah, so it was really hard.
Because you got really close to those people, and you almost feel like you abandoned them. Is what you're?
Yeah, that's what it felt like. It felt like, you know, we promised to be there, and now we're not. And I felt really terrible about that. So that was really hard.
Mm. I'm sorry to hear that. So when you went to El Kur, which is in North Sudan, why were you going into that location? What was going on at the time?
So they had an epidemic. So it's a normal disease, but there was a higher rate in those couple of years of leishmaniasis, which is called Kala-Azar, which is transmitted by a sandfly. And really the people that are already malnourished are in more danger. And it is a 90% death rate without treatment.
Whoa.
And the treatment that we have was not really that effective and it was not the best treatment, but it was the only one we were allowed to use. You know, 10 to 20% of them would have renal failure from the treatment and die. A couple of days.
Wow, what a disaster. Yeah. So was it as large of a staff going in there?
Yes, because it was a completely different situation. So here it was 2 days' drive from Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, so just 100 metres by 100 metres. So what we had when I arrived was 300 inpatients plus their families living inside the centre and having all their food, washing, cooking needs met inside that place. So we had about 30 live-in local staffs, four or five international staff, and another 100 locals who lived in a town that we were in. It's a very small rural town.
Wow. And now what about the threat on your life regarding the sand fly or flea? Is it a flea or a fly?
Fly. We just had, there was also a malaria outbreak at the same time, and we had TB and measles as well, but that didn't spread at all. We had to sleep in mosquito nets in our tuchels, mm-hmm. And basically it was, I didn't take anti-malarials because I found them disturbing on the brain at night. But just covering up from head to foot. So I did end up getting malaria because I got one bite. But we had all the testing facilities in the lab that would test for, you know, malaria. You'd have a result in an hour. So
sure.
Straight away.
And how were you treating malaria? What did you use an injection or a pharmaceutical drug or?
Just a drug. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and quinine or?
Yeah, it wasn't. I can't even remember now how long ago it was. It was one of the newer ones, but quinine was still effective there, so we would use that. But for the Kala-Azar, it was an injection, one injection every day for 30 days.
Oh, my God.
painful.
Oh, it's like really thick?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's like building up your immune system.
Mm.
Yeah. I remember getting a gamma globulin shot and I thought I was going to die. Never again. Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned that one of the main challenges was the movement of drugs and no name on the bag that's supposed to be covering the drugs from the doctor to the patient or from, you know, from staff and that kind of thing. Like this was something you wanted to make sure you stayed on top of because they would get so busy.
Yeah. I can't remember that very well.
I can't imagine how much pandemonium is there when you're going into these locations and it's urgent and, you know, it's like a life-death situation and you're trying desperately to keep this, you know, flow of a process going with people that either don't speak your language or do, that are not trained or are, you know, I just can't even imagine it.
No, well, the place was set up because there'd basically be going an ongoing emergency for a year. So it started off escalating. So I wasn't there for that time, but it was a year on. So, I mean, all our local staff were getting tired and exhausted, and we kept trying to tell the head office, you know, we're really overworked and no one's really had a break. Things are really reaching a bit of a tipping point here. They're like, but why? You know, a year ago we had more cases. I said, but now we've got Calazar plus malaria plus everyone's been here for a year and they're struggling now to keep up. So, that's what happened. Everybody, the local staff, they're really... It got too much.
Was there any kind of program to support the staff to get through these kind of conditions?
No.
Yeah, I bet, because the funding's not available for that, is it?
Well, we didn't even have power. We had solar power for 3 hours every night, so we had a running ICU with no power except between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m.
Wow. I think I remember you mentioned something about some of these injections and drugs have to be refrigerated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. I think we had a very small refrigerator, but I mean, it was so hot that you wonder whether the medications have any effect after a while. But I mean, they did because we did have a high cure rate. But I was looking after 0 to 5s and when I worked out the death rate, mortality rate, it was up to almost 25% of that.
Wow. Because that's really hard, Helen. That's really hard on your psyche to see that much death going on and on and on. So, I mean, when I was reading your report, I was like, how do all of these people get through this over an extended period of time? Because it's very traumatic.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people don't, and maybe they keep going in the field because they don't know what else to do. But I've had a lot of people that worked with me over those times that have passed on. Probably, you know, unhealthy conditions, stressful, dangerous. Yeah, all those types of things. Yeah.
And when you say 25%, was there like a goal of, you know, I mean, what's the norm? If you go into some of these situations, I'm just curious.
Yeah, that was really way above what it should have been, which is what made me think, oh God, you know, what's happening? And it was basically the babies were dying overnight because you'd have to be pretty malnourished to get leishmaniasis from that fly bite. So they're already vulnerable and that disease makes you malnourished. So the babies would be severely malnourished, which means they'd only be able to have a certain amount of food with low protein, I think, so they wouldn't die. But if the mothers tried to feed them as they started getting better, they would die from overload of food and too much protein, so they would die overnight.
Wow.
But what happened was after I realised, you know, how bad the figures were, when I worked it out, it felt like I was really doing nothing. I walked back through the ICU, and as I walked, I had one of those moments where I just, you know, looked at, it was only about 10 or 12 beds in there, and I realised instantly as I looked at each child which baby was going to die.
Wow.
And I had this realisation, oh my God, I know which ones are going to die. Mm. And I went back to my tukul and sat there and realized I wasn't crying. And I realized, wow, I'm in trouble. I'm not crying. I realize now that this is going to have a big, big impact later on. Yeah.
I bet. And I think you said later on you did suffer from PTSD, right?
Yeah.
Significantly.
Yeah.
How can you not? I mean, if you have any kind of heart, compassion, consciousness, or conscience.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
There's just no way that you couldn't. This is why all the vets come home very, very conflicted, because they really don't want to do what they're doing in most cases. Now, I thought it was interesting, too. I mean, you also got into the dynamic of the mother and what she feels that she needs to feed the child, the babies.
Yeah.
And you got into that. Can you talk to us a little bit about the challenges of working with the newborn moms, you know, newborn baby moms?
Mm. So, I mean, the babies, I mean, they're so tiny, so it wouldn't be unheard of to have a one-year-old that might be still 4 kilos.
Which would be how many pounds?
About 8 pounds.
Okay.
So basically the same weight as a newborn in our countries. So really severely malnourished. So, yeah, because they'd have this malnourishment and you can't have too much protein on board, so we would have to feed them their milk, which would give them everything they needed to survive. But they needed this basically to get them out of the malnourished state while they're having the medications for Kalazar, which is also quite dangerous. So, yeah, if they fed them anything other than that, the children would usually die because they'd have overloaded protein, which their bodies couldn't cope with at that time. So that was really hard to explain to the mothers, that we're giving them this milk and, you know, we're doing that because we're managing the symptoms, but, you know, they thought, you know, they're getting better, feed them some of their food.
Yeah, with totally pure intentions. And
yeah, exactly, yeah.
I would imagine that was really painful to deal with that. Mm. Now, you also said something about there would be like severe rainy seasons. How did that impact the traffic coming into the compound?
In the end, we got completely cut off. So just after we sent the international doctor out, we basically got cut off by floods, which was so significant that, it's a war-torn country. We've got people from South Sudan, which are a lot of the educated staff, the doctors and the trained nurses, and the North Sudanese, who are more Arabic and Islam. So you've got that conflict already there, and then we became flooded in. So then we have a decrease in medications. Basically, everybody in the town is cut off also. So what we had was a situation where the police were arresting our local staff on charges to get money out of them.
Oh, my God.
And we didn't have any – we were running out of medications and stuff. And basically the Nile had risen so much that it was lapping at our compound at every wall. Except for the one connecting to the town. And it was too much, and the only doctor that we had left, all the rest were medical aides, so to speak, not fully trained doctors. She just started running up and down screaming because she couldn't cope. So basically I had to look after her for 2 days and keep her away from the other staff, because the other staff weren't able to deal with her, because she was the one they looked up to as the one authority figure left. They didn't cope with that.
She ended up becoming suicidal, did she not?
Yeah, she reverted to basically full breakdown. So we were feeding and doing everything for her for 48 hours until we managed to get a helicopter in to get her out.
Good God. I mean, it just goes to show you the amazing sacrifice that these people have, like yourself, have gone through in order to help and serve these locations, you know, because they've got to be on. You know, you guys are on. You don't have that time to just kind of cope and deal and really chill with what so much activity going on and so much life death scenario.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's very hard to.
It's crazy. And also, what about the food? I mean, if you guys were cut off from the flooding, was there also people trying to rip off the food?
Yeah, pretty. Not so much the food. There was a big, there was a lot of drugs going missing, but we didn't have much food. We had the same food as them. So you're looking at, if we got a cow for all the staff, by the time it got cut up and shared around the cooking staff and stuff and reached our table of for 30, we'd have three small pieces of meat each from a whole goat.
Wow.
Yeah, but basically it's okra. So okra makes it thick and slimy. So you're looking at really sweet spaghetti noodles type stuff with a thickened dip because of okra, with just like green stuff growing off the side of the side to put in it. So it's high sugar intake and really hungry all the time, and it's because it's so hot, you're just drinking coffee after coffee and sugar, sugar, sugar. So it's really, yeah, it's...
Really hard on the adrenals.
Yeah, really.
Really hard on the adrenals. You must have lost a ton of weight.
Not really.
Really?
Yeah, no, not really. Yeah, I think because you're eating so much sugar, I mean, I didn't put on or lose really, but I was really quite sick for a while there with, I think I had some warm camel's milk because I was so hungry and that didn't do well.
Yeah, I bet. Now, what about the disposal of the needles?
Yeah, well, I was just walking home one day, and I see you know the cleaner or the guard or whatever with a wheelbarrow and a tin of sharps, an empty open bucket, and he must have seen me or panicked or whatever. But he's dropped them on the floor, and he's raced to pick them up in front of me, you know, because he wants to get clean. And there's needles everywhere, and I'm like, oh my God, is this what we do? Seriously? You've got to go through the whole camp with a wheelbarrow of sharps to the disposal place out the back. So yeah, I put a whole another thing in place, and because we got the oil from the I think that was from the WSO tins, they come from America originally, so yeah, they just had a hole, so I made them use those because you couldn't get them back out.
What? So tell us an amazing experience there that really left an impact on your life.
Yeah. As it came to flood and it sort of calmed down, there was an intense pressure of a smell and a feel and an energy of something really deep and nasty coming. And I think that's why people started to lose it, because we weren't sure whether it was going to happen here where we were. And so even walking to the river one day, the actual old cemetery was being washed away from the flood. So you would actually see a skull, the ribs, the legs, and they were washing down. And I was so distressed that I was walking with two of my medical assistants, and I walked off down the river, and I actually walked into part of the jungly part, and for about 10 meters before I realized, oh my God, I'm in a place where I can't be seen with two men, which could cause significant trouble for me in the town. So quickly turn around and get back. But I, at that point, I wasn't really thinking. But what that was, the increased military, increased stress, increased real dark energy, was actually the genocide starting in Darfur at that time.
And you're so intuitive and shamanistic that you totally got what was going on an energetic level.
Yeah, I did. And the other thing was, because we found a lot of theft that was going right up into the community, the heads of the community in that time, is that we thought we had some black voodoo, because the doctor that left, he had a black dead cat thrown on his mat, front mat, and I was doing a meditation, and as I was sitting in my tukul doing a meditation, I had this intense smell, which I don't usually get, and it was a pungent smell, and as I opened my eyes, on the other side of the tukul at eye level was a black scorpion, which then I had to stop the meditation and catch and get it out.
Wow.
So
voodoo is very, very alive in that location of the world.
Yeah. So what we thought was, they're really giving us a clear warning, like, you know, back off, or, you know, so we're managing everything else, and we're finding theft, and we're having to, okay, let's just go back a step and just put some measures in place and not go any further with that.
It's crazy. So how long did the flooding last before it eased up?
Well, we actually got evacuated by helicopter, so, and they put more supplies and more staff in to take our place. So it was another couple of weeks after that that the floods subsided.
So actually other people, other recruits went in exchange for you leaving?
Yep.
Oh, my God. And are they still there, Helen?
I don't even know about that particular place. I'm pretty sure they would have closed it down because it was just, you know, it's like a disease that has a couple of years where it increases and then can go silent again. So if there wasn't the need for that particular disease, which is why that care centre opened, they may have closed it down, or they handed it over to a local organisation to take over and do what they want with.
And I do know that you talked a great deal about health education. Do you feel that Doctors Without Borders and the work that all of you did, do you feel that that's left some sort of mark on these locations where they're able to take better care of themselves? You know, maybe just everything from basics of, you know, not having a gazillion babies to, you know, better hygiene to, you know, what are some of the things they can do if they feel they're dehydrated? I'm just wondering, you know, it's one thing to go in and take care of an emergency situation, but like, what mark have you left, you know, with their wisdom, you know?
We had a lot of educators. So we within the camp, we had an area where we do further training. So the locals would do that further training for them. And with various, you know, themes and stuff. But even within that group, and we had people that spoke Arabic and, you know, South Sudanese, there was still about another 12 languages apart from that. So there was a real difficulty, and even the people speaking Arabic, and they're like, no, she's from another tribe, she's over there, she speaks a different language.
Amazing.
So, just so complex.
And I would imagine when you're in countries like this, breastfeeding is very common, right?
But there's no other way. There's no bottles. No.
So you mentioned something about weaning, training the mothers to wean their children off of the mother's milk. Why was that, I guess, is my question.
I guess they're not getting the nutrition from the breast milk anymore after they're, you know, about one or two. So, they need to be having real food. And what we found was actually they were just feeding the babies breast milk too much, and so they weren't getting the nutrition that they needed after a certain point.
So they really don't know any better.
Well, no, they don't know any better, and there was no food. I had an interesting case where I had a pair of twins that we looked after, and we looked after them once, and the sick twin got completely treated for Kalazar. She went away, and 6 months later she came back and she was sick again, and I sat with an interpreter and the mother, and I said, you know, we gave you all this stuff, and, you know, we gave the information, and, yeah, no, all that was fine, all that was good, and so what happened? And she said, oh, well, my husband is not the father of these twins, and I didn't have enough food for them.
Oh, wow.
So one twin died. The other twin had such a personality that she'd get food off people because she would entertain and light up the whole room. So she made this person, and she's only a toddler, she's made this personality that instantly attracts everybody's attention, and she gets all this food, so she's really chubby. Whereas the other baby had, you know, completely given up, so was screwed up and, you know, just gave up, but basically didn't have enough food, didn't have the fight.
So sad. And what was the difference you felt between Northern Sudan versus Afghanistan as far as what would be one of the most significant cultural challenges?
I found the people in Sudan had more psychological ancestral damage, I would say, from the war that had been going on for them. That's quite brutal in that country. Yeah.
Good God. So you got evacuated. And it was this like in a helicopter?
Yeah.
With the American military?
No, we actually, our head of mission in Khartoum was away, and it was the financial person that was in charge. And he obviously he didn't want to spend money because he's looking at the finances. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry, but there's no other way. He's like, oh, seriously, Helen, you're a helicopter? I said, you're going to have to just do it, mate. You have to get us out. So as we injected the doctor that we were, flying with, and me and another local girl, because I needed some help because she was so big and strong, we actually were on top of her in the helicopter because we were trying to keep her on the floor so she wouldn't open the doors while we were shot.
Oh, my God. You need to write a book about this. My God.
I have thought about it, but I haven't got there yet.
Yeah, I bet. So, okay, so how much of a break did you have between leaving Northern Sudan and then ending up in Nepal?
It was, again, almost 3 months, but I went a bit early because they said, we got a position before Christmas. Can you come? And I said, oh, yeah, I'll come. I'll be there. So I was there for Christmas. Yeah.
So of these three particular projects that you attended and monitored and oversaw and that kind of thing, which one was the most intense?
Afghanistan was intense because of the war situation and all those, but I think Sudan was the hardest, the most distressing because of the situation and the conditions and the death and, yeah.
So now you're in Jumla, Nepal. Now, why were you called to go there?
Well, when I got out of Sudan, I went to my head office in Amsterdam to the head of the country. And I walked in. I wasn't, debriefing. He's like, well, Helen, I heard that you sort of sorted things out in Sudan. You sort of, fixed up the mission and solved all the problems there. So where would you like to go next? And I said, he said, do you want to go to Somalia? I was like, it's a bit rough. I said, I don't really want to go to Somalia. What about Colombia? I was like, well, I'm trying to get out of the hot countries. Have you got anywhere cool? Nepal in the mountains. I said, perfect, I'll go. Yep.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it.
So it looks like you walked into a major political scenario.
Yes. So
tell us what you walked into. Very interesting.
Well, when I arrived, the manager of the mission, it was really a small mission, so we only had about 12 staff and 3 international staff. He was just leaving to go out on holiday, but what happened when he left and went to Khartoum was he was arrested and deported, because what he had been doing was trying to get a message to the Maoists who were out in the country. So he was giving it to a local health worker lady who took it to the Maoists, but then the Maoists got shot by the army, and the letter from MSF was found and the lady was arrested and put in jail. So suddenly I'm in charge. he's been deported and the lady's in prison. And what they didn't want us to do is they didn't want us walking around. They didn't want us communicating with the Maoists because they were in a war with them, and our activity walking through the hills and going to these places put us in danger, and the military didn't want us to know where they were, and vice versa. So we were really a hiccup in the way. So we were actually stopped from doing any work at all. Yeah.
So how long were you there, just kind of in this stalemate situation?
Yeah, well, it was a couple of months. Yeah.
And at one point you actually tried to negotiate, I think that's what I read, with I forgot who it was.
Yeah, well, it was the head of the police, the head of the army and the main government. So because this lady had been arrested, her husband was an alcoholic who wasn't coping. And so they left this lady in prison to put pressure on us, and they encouraged the population and him, the group, to, attack us pretty much to get us out, to give us enough push to get us out of the country. So yeah, when I was negotiating with the head of the army, it was basically, to try and get that lady out of prison. That was our main objective at that point.
Were you successful in doing that?
Yes, but I had to leave the mission. So another really good point about MSF is that you are working in a hierarchy, but if you have doubts about anyone's decisions or orders, you can go above their head if you give logical and clear explanation for that. So, you know, you'd have to stand in front of that person and give your arguments about why you disagree. So at that point, I was writing to Amsterdam saying that I think now our position is dangerous. We're putting our lives, mental health of our locals at risk because the community has turned against us and they will turn further against the local community. And since we're not allowed to work, we need to evacuate, and that's my decision. And they agreed with my decision and we closed the unit.
So what was the perceived threat from their perspective of you arriving in Nepal?
That we would see what was going on, that we would communicate with the Maoists and help them that were seen to be the other side and the warring faction. What we found was, they were sort of, whoever they killed, they would say it was Maoist, but it wasn't actually the case that they were.
Yeah. Mm. And it appears that when you did confront the head of the police, he was acting like he didn't know what was really happening.
Yeah, right. He's a very, very intelligent man, and he wouldn't give anything away.
And do you think that's because if he had acknowledged it, they probably would have taken him out or something, because it's so politically...
Yeah, exactly.
That's just so crazy. So you really didn't work on that many people. Why were you pulled in there in the first place? Was there an epidemic of some sort?
No, we realised that there was a situation of the war with the Maoists and that it might officially become a war. So what we were trying to do is just get established within the country before it started, so we were already in place if it deteriorated further. But, yeah.
And how did you end up leaving that area and location?
Yeah, well, towards the end when, you know, the stalemate was happening, nothing was happening with the negotiations, we couldn't get the lady out, someone said, there's a mob coming up the street, they're on the way. There was 15 people led by the husband, and they basically put locks on the door and threatened to burn us down inside.
My God.
So after they left, I said, the boss was there from Kathmandu at that point, I said, do we have any plan for, you know, evacuation or, you know, whatever if a mob comes? No, we don't. I say, can we just make one? How about this? We take our personal items. If they come up, anybody sees them, we leave the house open, the computer's on, everything. We just walk outside because we have nothing to hide. They can take our equipment. They can take our information. We go down and sit in riot formation, which is passive riot formation. So sit on the floor with the locals and non-aggressive. So,
and did you have to do that?
Yeah, the next morning they said I got the call. There's about 50 people coming up the road. I said, right, all in place. Everything open. They can burn the house down. They can get access to all the files, computers. They can take our equipment. They can do anything. But what we want is we want the locals who speak the language not to be the main source of conflict, not to interpret for us in a conflict situation. So we sat passive on the ground outside. And they surrounded us for 3 hours, and it was only when some of the local girls started getting a bit uncomfortable on the cold rocks that they managed to divide the group. And then they had me held up out the front, and it was starting to get a bit physical before the manager decided to walk the crowd down to the police station, talk directly to the police about it, and lead them away. That was 3 hours.
So they were armed, I would assume, right?
They were armed, and they were trying to, they were trying to provoke a fight and cause us to, you know, react, but we stayed in passive.
My God. So how did you end up finally leaving the location?
Well, it was a couple of days after that I said, you know, it's really not worth it. So we were already kicked out of the country. We were already officially not allowed to work, and we were all waiting to be kicked out by gunpoint. And at that point, we're all sitting around the table, and we see about six police officers with rifles come and tap on the door. And I'm holding my breath, say, oh, here we go. We're going to get thrown out at gunpoint. And one of the locals opens the door, and he comes in. I said, what did he want? And he goes, He wants a stretcher. I said, pardon? He wants a stretcher. One of the policemen's hurt himself. I was like, ah, give him the stretcher.
Anything, just give it to him.
No, I don't care. So, yeah, we basically packed up, closed the mission, packed up within a couple of days and made an early morning exit on the plane to quietly and peacefully and, you know, back away. And then the prisoner was released not long after we did that.
Oh, that's terrific. Mm. Well, that's the good thing that came out of it, huh?
Yeah. And so also, you know, the locals were not damaged anymore and not seen to be, you know, just supporting us. So they would have had a chance to hopefully reintegrate within that community.
It said, I think in one of your reports, it said something about the head of the police was blaming the donors. Can you clarify why was he so upset about that? Something about blaming the donors for not doing anything.
Yeah, I can't.
You said he didn't have any problems and you were actually challenging him and saying, no, I don't think that's correct. And he said he cannot work in the Maoist area, cannot do any of the programs in the various districts. He blames the donors for not doing anything, but cannot say why the donors do not act on a higher level.
I guess that would just be on a funding basis, probably, that they wanted funding, and we weren't funding and providing support unless we could have access to the people that were most in need. And we were assessing that they were the people, you know, in the communities that were 2 days walk away, and that was the reason we wanted to get to those areas. But that was also apparently where the Maoists were, so they didn't want our funds going to the other side of the war, and they wanted it used in the town for, you know, their people, not the fighting factions. And we don't discriminate. We were helping the people in the midwife in the town and the hospital in the town and providing support for that, but we're not an endless supply of money. And that would be
probably. Oh my God. So now that we've gone through all three of those scenarios, you know, how has this changed your life, especially in your career as a nurse?
Well, it was very, very difficult to come back, and what I find was and still find the most difficult is that, you know, we have such waste in our hospitals here, and such over-treatment, I feel, in a lot of cases, whereas they're accepting of death over there and they have their challenges, but they live each day and they take death as it's a part of life and it's a natural progression, whereas over here we seem to fight it. So the only way I was able to stay in nursing, and I'm not now, is to each day say, you know, please leave me to the person that wishes to talk about death today on this day.
Which you've become very astute in assisting the souls. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I guess I have a way of realizing when someone's getting to the end, either by medical, because of medical reasons or the disease process, or because they have emotionally, you know, given up, they might be going to a nursing home. So it was those people that I used to, or, you know, cancer that was really untreatable, and they weren't always told that that was a possibility, you know. So all I was giving is a possibility, an option, you know. Death is an option. It is an option. It is a choice. You don't have to continue to have treatment. This will be the, you know, this will be the result. If you do have this treatment, you know, you still will not be able to walk. You may still have to go to a nursing home because you will never get home again. So have you thought about, you know, death as an option?
I was talking to a friend of mine who's also a nurse, and I said, you know, there's not anything in this matrix that's natural anymore. I mean, you can't, it's a rare moment to have a mother give birth in a natural way, where I'm sure you're aware of this. In many cultures, they leave the mother with the baby on her belly with the cord intact for a very specific period of time. I think it's like 8 hours or 12 hours or something, so that the baby receives the full nourishment and the full energetic separation from the mother, so it's not this like bam, you know, cut the cord.
That's right. And I did a lotus birth with my two, so I didn't cut the cord for 48 hours.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, I cut it myself after 48 and it was drying hard at that point. And
incredible.
Buried them in a garden under a tree, which is Aboriginal culture, as well as a lot of others probably. Yeah.
Right on. And now look at the way that people die. I mean, it's basically like you're not even allowed to die.
Well, that's it. They're not given the option. They're just always given this false hope that, you know, more treatment. But that's really just avoiding the issue of that your end result is death. How far do you want to go on? I thought of an example last night to tell you as in a palliative care unit where they had started people that had a massive stroke, brainstem that was incurable, knew it was incurable. They were stopping doing treatment and they were sending them directly to palliative care. So I got this very robust man in his early 50s, strong, would never have taken any rubbish. And as he came in, he was purpley blue and, you know, gasping, close to death, all these things. And we said to his family, just give us a few minutes and we'll sort him out. So we got him in and while the other nurse was finding some T-shirts for him to wear because we didn't have gowns, we had nice bedding and nice T-shirts, I just held him and rocked him and said, listen, this is the situation. You've had a stroke. You are going to be severely impaired. This is not somewhere where we will keep you alive. This is not a nursing home. This is a palliative care unit. We're going to keep you comfortable. We're going to keep you clean and dry. We are not going to keep you alive. You will die, but you don't have to die at the moment. You don't have to die now. You can just take a breath, take your time, calm down. And all this time I'm, you know, rocking him back and forth and just talking to him, till he just calmed down, started breathing normally, had a T-shirt on. His family came in 10 minutes later and they said, oh, my God, it's different here. What did you do? I just said, oh, I just explained the situation and told him what was going on.
Right on. And I know that there's a huge call for more nurses and more practitioners and healers for transition.
Well, I think, but even within the medical profession, it's an area that is very feared and people have their own individual issues with it and people don't deal with it well at all. Yeah. But so, yeah, absolutely. And it can be such a beautiful thing. I mean, one lady who I looked after, and I think what you have to do is you have to spiritually connect eye to eye and understand where they're coming from as if you were them or their sister or whatever and talk to them. And one lady who'd been severely disabled and in hospital most of her life, and she was only in her 30s, and she was one of the most difficult patients we ever had. I really got, you know, over the bed, into her face. What is the matter? Why are you afraid to die? What is it? What is it? And she was told when she was very young that she could go to hell. And that was it. Yeah. And as soon as I said, you know, that's not really the case. You know, you're going to have a different body. You've done your time. You've been suffering. Go and dance. Go and fly. Go and do something else. You're not going to go to hell. You're not.
Right on.
And then they let go and, you know, she died over a couple of days.
Peacefully. Oh, my gosh. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So she's out of all that misery. And to be so young and have a life that was consumed with that. Mm. You know? Helen, tell me your Aboriginal experiences. You know, did that come after or before? The
6 months before. And
okay.
After I'd been back in Melbourne 17 months after doing MSF, I actually realised I wanted to move some more, and I went into the Aboriginal Museum in Melbourne on my own, and I saw one of the paintings, and I saw that the guy had done it, had the white was dripping into the black painting, and I went, oh my God, the culture's being lost right now. Mm-hmm. It was 5 years on, and I got a message say, go back to the community. Okay. I went back to the same community for 6 months, 5 years later.
Oh my gosh, so what happened? Tell us a little bit about that. Got a little more time. Maybe a few more minutes.
Yeah, the Aboriginal community where I went, they really only had connection with white people from the 60s on, and the last race in 80 to come out of the desert was not far away as well. Although we had an old fella who was in his 90s in the first time I was there, he used to walk from Central Australia to Adelaide, and he used to bring back, I think it was tea, sugar and flour. So he was so even though, you know, we say there was no white connection, I mean, when they were wanting to connect, they would go down and get what they needed and come back. But the white people were not actually in that area until 1960. So there's a huge change in culture and diet and, you know, ways of living. So what I noticed over the 5 years was, you know, the old people were dying, but then the next generation was also dying from kidney failure, and the 30-year-olds were getting chronic illness. So you were losing, like, you know, almost two generations at once, and a lot of change in culture for them.
Wow. And, I mean, do you feel that they are going to come back, that they're surviving, that there's still a desire to keep the old ways and the old wisdom alive?
A lot of it is, I think, going to be lost, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's very sad. But, yeah, I mean, they do have a connection to the earth, which I don't think you can. And what I took from it was wow, there's ways of being that is more suited to the planet, which comes from the Aborigines. And I think there's more that we can learn and adopt their lifestyle than vice versa. There has to be some in between. They can't come fully to us without damaging their culture because it's different. Yeah. So we have to meet somewhere in between, Phil.
Oh, my gosh. Did you actually stay with them, live with them, walk with them?
Uluru and the Olgas? Mm-hmm. Olgas? Yeah, so basically you take a left at the Olgas and go for 4 hours across country to Western Australia, and that's where you are. So it's 5 hours from Ayers Rock, Uluru, or 12 hours from Alice Springs. So it's really remote. We'd have anything from 50 to 600 people living in the community. So you live in community. Basically, there's a shop, a clinic, office, and a school. That's it. And all your little town, all your houses in there. So you're on call 24 hours a day. You basically got the health of the whole community in your hands while you're there. And, you know, if someone dies, expect attack first and dealing with the problems and who's responsible later. So really a huge responsibility to keep them safe and alive and healthy while you're there.
Did you use more natural means like herbology and things like that and energetic healing, or was it still more the pharmaceutical?
I was really doing the pharmaceutical side, although I did have some Aboriginal shamanic healers, and I used to give them the space in the clinic for them to come in, and I was very happy for them to do that and have a little look at what they were doing as well. Yeah, so they still did their own healing, and we made sure we got the main healers in through the clinic as we could. But, it was basically, you know, you got your diabetes, you got your ear infections, skin infections, diarrheas and stuff like that, the same.
Unbelievable. Well, I just want to thank you. Seriously, I want to thank you humbly for the service that you've provided all of these different people, races, cultures, continents, and sincerely grateful for people like yourself who are doing this kind of work. And do you want anyone to contact you? Because if so, we can give them your email address.
You can give them
okay, go ahead and tell them where you want them to be contacted.
I'm on Facebook as well under Helen Latham, or it's Helen.Latham at aapt.net.au.
Okay, so it's Helen.Latham at aapt.com. Okay.
.net.
Okay, so Helen.Latham at aapt.net, or you can look her up at Facebook, Helen Latham, and it's L-E-A-T-H-A-M. And so hopefully this was as fascinating to all of you as it was to me. I met her as a fellow guardian, and I'm just honored to meet somebody that really put their lives on the lines for something they felt very strongly to do. I hope everyone sees what we are needing for our future. This is just another idea for all of those out there that are really searching in their hearts as to how they want to serve the planet. This is a huge area that needs to be addressed. And I hope that this gives some inspiration to those of you out there that are really into medicine and wanting to look at it from an alternative point of view that is not necessarily invasive or destructive to the body. So as always, sending you all lots and lots of love. Check out the Galactic Connection blog. It's 365 days a year at galacticconnection.com. And also, we are going to be coming up with even some more new services. I've got some new essences coming soon. Stay tuned. And of course, we are the world-renowned leader for the implant removal processes. Stage 1, 2, 3, and we now have 4. We're about to add a 5th. So hope you guys enjoyed this, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks again, Helen, for all you do and what you've shared with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Take care, everyone.